Hey, this is Jen Johans at FilmIntuition.com and Film Intuition on social media and Letterboxd. And this is Watch with Jen.
This is the Hitchcock Hotel. A Hitchcock fanatic with an agenda invites old friends for a weekend stay at his secluded, themed hotel in this fiendishly clever, suspenseful new novel from the international best-selling author of Darling Rosegold. Alfred Smetel is not your average Hitchcock fan. He is the founder, owner, and manager of the Hitchcock Hotel, a sprawling Victorian house in the White Mountains dedicated to the master of suspense. There, Alfred offers his guests round-the-clock film screenings, movie props, and memorabilia in every room, plus an aviary with 50 crows. To celebrate the hotel's first anniversary, he invites his former best friends from his college film club for a reunion. He hasn't spoken to any of them in 16 years. Not after what happened. But who better than them to appreciate Alfred's creation and to help him finish it? After all, no Hitchcock set is complete without a body. Well, this week I am so thrilled to have on a new guest, somebody I connected with thanks to our mutual friend, Natalie Jenner. Stephanie Robel is an international and USA Today best-selling author. Her debut, Darling Rosegold, has sold rights in 21 countries and was a finalist for the Edgar Award for Best First Novel. Robel grew up in Chicago. She now lives in New York City. Her latest book is The Wonderful Hitchcock Hotel, which I loved and I cannot wait to talk about. So Stephanie, thank you so much for being here. How are you?
Oh, thank you for having me, Jen. I'm doing well, considering, you know, the book's been out a week today. It's Tuesday, right?
Yes.
if that tells you my state of mind at all, like that's, it's been a bit of a whirlwind, but in the best way. I think so far the reception to the book has been wonderful. And it was really lovely last week to be on the road and get to meet so many people, including you. We got to meet in Scottsdale.
Yes. And I got to meet your mom in line, which was great. Yes.
Yeah. She lives in Scottsdale. She is very happy to tell everyone that she knows that she is my mother. So it's very sweet.
I love that. Yeah. And when you were talking about your love of writing and it starting from a young age, you mentioned like writing a short story, a mystery when you were a girl. So tell me more about that.
Yeah, I don't know if I'd qualify it as a mystery. It was called okay. How Marianne Got Lost at the Zoo. It was okay. told from Marianne's point of view.
Wow.
Although I certainly didn't know that at the time. But yep, she was just this girl that went to the zoo with her brother and her parents. She got lost and then Whoa. She sat in a gorilla enclosure and Ooh. All was fine. Yeah.
Okay.
Then, her family found her, or maybe she found them. To be honest, it's been a while, so I can't really remember. But yeah, it was pretty, there was some conflict, I suppose, but it was pretty, pretty short to the point story.
But I love that. I wrote like novels and short stories and scripts mm-hmm. from a young age. I tried to join the writing staff of Seinfeld when I was 11. And was writing, like I submitted a script. I did all of that just on my own. My parents were like,
that's
I don't
amazing.
Know. And writing weird novels. Like I remember one, which was about a woman who is a journalist who uncovers a scandal with the lottery, you know, the person who pulls the balls. It was a whole thing. And
that
was before the movie Lucky Numbers came out. I don't know. I probably heard something. Yes. Yeah, so I was doing that from a young age too. So I always loved that. And then you went into advertising first. So tell me more about that transition. And then you went to your MFA program. And how did that all happen?
Sure. So I was always told in school that like English and writing were my best subjects. So, I was kind of trying to think through college, like what's a more practical application of creative writing? Because I was like, surely no one can actually make a living doing this, this being writing fiction. So I decided to go into advertising, and I worked in that industry for 7 or 8 years as a copywriter. So I was writing a lot of TV spots and, billboard, copy, digital print, every medium you can think of. And then I moved to London with my then fiance, now husband. We were supposed to just go for 2 years, and the advertising industry there, it turns out, is very competitive. And it's a lot harder to fire people in the UK. And so to get a salaried position is a lot more of an undertaking. So I was working freelance jobs the entire first 2 years that we lived there, and there was a lot of unemployment. And so at one point, it had been a couple months since my last job, and I kind of felt like, well, I have a lot less to lose now. So I thought, I've been wanting to apply to MFA programs for years, but it's hard to walk away from like a solid job and do that. As we all know, an MFA in creative writing is not exactly the job ticket that, some other
No.
graduate degrees might be. So anyway, so I decided to apply. I applied to 12 programs, and then I ended up at Emerson College in Boston. I was like, I'm going to give myself 2 years to write a novel, see what happens. And my thesis there ended up becoming my debut, Darling Rosegold.
That is so amazing. It's a wonderful program there at Emerson, so I'm glad that you chose that. And I mean, what great experience to, go through the whole process of querying and like practicing and working with smart people to kind of guide you and guide that manuscript that led to your first book, and now you're on, this is your third book, is that right?
Third published book, which is crazy. I can still remember faintly now, but when when I got the very first book deal and just being like, oh my God, I'm gonna have a published book. So, the idea that it would become a career and releasing a book every other year is like, it's bananas.
That's so much work. And this one was quite an undertaking. I think you said, though, you wrote it faster than your other books. Is that correct?
It's hard with the debut because you're not on a timeline to really
That's
like
true.
discuss the timeline. But the second book, This Might Hurt, took me about 1.5 years to 2 years and 7 drafts. So lots and lots of rewrites. Whereas this one from start to finish took 10 months. And it was really just like one major rewrite and then like a lot of, smaller edits. So it's tough to say like why exactly this one came out so much faster. I don't know if it's, if I just got lucky this time around, if it's because I kind of changed my process a little bit. Maybe it was just like an easier topic for me to dive into. It's very hard to kind of do that, post-writing analysis to figure that out. But I'm very grateful that, it took the time that it took.
Yeah, I think it was really cool when I was listening to you in conversation with John at Poison Pen, and there were some really brilliant questions being asked of you by audience members and people watching the live event on YouTube as well. Some of my favorite things you talked about was mentioning it's like 90,000 words basically for a novel around there, and just getting into the rhythm of momentum every day when people are like, oh my God, it's such an undertaking. Well, if you can set aside, like I'm going to hit 1,000 words, 500 a week, whatever that amount is, and just stick to it and make those goals that you set for yourself and then get on the path, that's a good way of doing it. And then the other thing that I thought was fascinating about you talking about the process for Hitchcock Hotel was saying how you kind of maybe overplotted and went into overanalysis on the earlier books. Like, and you said, sometimes when you fill out these questionnaires, what is your main character, your second or third character's favorite drink when they were six or something, like they go a little extreme. And maybe you spent a lot of time, maybe too much time doing that. And this one, you didn't pants it essentially, but you did comparatively to the other books, which I thought was interesting. You didn't kind of like handcuff yourself to an outline or spend too much time doing that, which that was good. Did that help keep it fresh for you, do you think?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think there's just earlier on in my writing career, I think there was a sense of like, ever the good student, like, oh, yeah. I need to do a certain amount of homework before I can actually write. I can't just sit down and start writing a book off of what's already in my head, you know? And I'm sure there's still some resistance in me to doing that. But I do think the more books that I write, the more that I realize, you know, it's like that old phrase of like, don't let perfection be the enemy of progress. I think sometimes in the past, I just like, I wanted to have everything, like all my research, everything I needed to write it. And then I wanted to only write, but now it's a bit more, you know, plotting as I go, researching what I need as I go, writing, obviously as I go. And yeah, to your point about just the kind of writing at a steady clip, for me personally, it's much better to write a smaller number of words, but like keep at it every day than it is to write like, you know, 5,000 words in one clip, but then like come back to it 2 weeks later. There's, for me, the hardest writing day is always Monday, because the more days I've been away from it, the more resistance I have to going back in. So when I'm really in a deadline crunch, or sometimes just to like, you know, if my personal life is calm, then I will, you know, try to write 6 days a week. So it's not like the 2 days off. Even if it's just like 1,000 words or whatever on a Saturday morning, I just find for first draft specifically, it's like getting that keeping that momentum going. So much of writing a novel, I think, is momentum.
Yeah. And sitting down and doing it. And like you said about Monday, like wanting to do it after you've kind of had 2 days off. My friend William Boyle, who's a novelist, talks about how he stops. He's one of those people because of his kids gets up early, like really early, but he said he stops before he gets to a really exciting part. And that way the next day he's very excited to go back into it. And I think I would be tempted to like, ooh, I'm at that part now, and just kind of go through. So I thought that was interesting too. But one thing I loved about this is, and it's so ambitious and so brilliant, I have no idea how you did that, and I'm glad somebody asked you. So you're doing that Agatha Christie kind of thing in this, or, where you have a lot of characters, you're introducing a lot right away, you have several points of view that we rotate through all of these different characters as the book continues. And keeping them straight. I mean, you know, you do a good job for the reader, but as a writer, like starting that, I wondered how, and I was so glad somebody asked, and you said something interesting about the seven deadly sins. So I'm going to let you take it away on that.
Yeah, sure. So I had the same concerns as you did when I started out. My previous books have only been two or three points of view. I usually go pretty deep into those. And this one, I knew I needed six very good friends, and one surprise POV toward the end. Yeah. And I was not sure how I was going to differentiate these people in my mind, because they all went to college together. So they're all roughly the same age. Yeah. You know, they're all working white collar jobs. They kind of come from not the same area, but you know, they're all American, whatever. And so for some reason, the seven deadly sins came to mind, which is something I've always wanted to do a story around, like more explicitly than I have here. But, you know, the movie Seven kind of nailed it on the first try.
Yeah.
So what I ended up doing actually was, when I first had these characters, I just assigned each one of them one of the seven deadly sins. So, for example, Zoe is a chef, so she's gluttony. Julius is a trust fund kid, so he's sloth. And so these sins not only determined their jobs, but also their vices. And that was just a really simple, easy way for me to keep them differentiated in my own head at the beginning, until they kind of took on more a life of their own. Mm-hmm. And I think hopefully helps kind of keep them separate in the reader's mind as well. You know, I think if each of them kind of has a different Achilles heel, that also leads to what are their secrets, what are their, and I can remember actually once I had, you know, the sin for each of them, kind of had like, I hand drew this little table that had their names at the top. And it was like, what is their vice? What is their secret? Like, because of that, what's their secret? What do they want? You know, so having that rudimentary thing with just like a word in each box to start out with was, I didn't know it at the time, but was like hugely helpful and then proceeding.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, I love that so much. And another, of course, influence is Alfred Hitchcock, obviously the name of the book. And also, you kind of pay tribute to your professor who introduced you to North by Northwest in college. Was that your first Alfred Hitchcock movie?
It was, yeah, which is funny because, I mean, I like North by Northwest, but I might have said this even on Wednesday night, was like the espionage thrillers are not my favorite Hitchcock movies. Mine are like the really dark psychological dives, perhaps no surprise there. But yeah, I had a professor named Dr. Scott, which is also the name of the professor in the book. And he was, I mean, he wasn't like a huge Hitchcock fan. We saw a whole variety of classic films, but the reason he was so instrumental is I seriously doubt, as someone who was in college in, you know, 2007, 2008, 2009, that I would have gone back and watched a lot of these movies of my own volition, you know? So, and so many of them were fantastic. It's just like, there's constantly more stuff coming out. As a young person, you don't necessarily, your first thought is not like, okay, let me go watch all these movies from the 40s and 50s. And I'm so grateful to him because he kind of like put Hitchcock in my head. And writing this book was an excuse to get to do a deeper dive beyond just sort of like the classics that, or I should say the most popular stuff that like most people, even non-Hitchcock fans, have seen.
Yeah, I was that nerdy kid who was watching like old movies as a girl. Hitchcock was probably my first favorite director. Vertigo really blew me away as a child. My mom loved Cary Grant, of course. So all the Cary Grant ones I watched. But yeah, so I was very excited to read this as a Hitchcock fan and see all the ways that you paid tribute to different plot lines. You talked about the psychological thrillers, the darker movies, even just some motifs that you see in Hitchcock movies, like milk and his use of food. And, you know, we have birds. And so all of those kind of things. Did you watch the movies, all of them, like before you started? Or was it kind of like as you were going? Or did you just write the book and then go back and kind of season it with Hitchcock?
I definitely did a deep dive of watching before I started writing. I'm not going to pretend I watched all 53, but, you know, probably a dozen or 20, somewhere around there at this point. I think I'd only seen, you know, North by Northwest, Psycho, maybe The Birds, you know, like just a few very basic ones. So I felt like in order to write it and put the motifs and themes and methods of violence, like to borrow all of that, I needed to actually start observing patterns. I was concurrently reading a biography about Hitchcock and then also a book length interview between him and François Truffaut, who's a French director.
Yes.
Oh, you have it. Yeah. Yes. I know, I have it too.
I love it.
It was nice to, you know, they would talk about these themes and Truffaut would kind of identify like, oh, this seems to really like, you really seem to keep revisiting this. And then I'd be, you know, at night, I'd be watching it actually in front, you know, on the screen in front of me. So I definitely did like a deep dive education on Hitchcock before I really got into the writing, just so, you know, the very worst thing that could possibly happen is I try to write a book with Hitchcock's name in the title and Hitchcock fans go in thinking they're getting, you know, someone who's, if not an expert, at least reasonably well-versed. And then yeah, there's just like nothing. So I really felt it was critical to get that, you know, get that background before I started writing.
Yeah. And there's even nods, like I love you named the college after Amal Revel as his wife, which was really cool. And so there's nods to his backstory and some of the history. And yeah, I think Hitchcock Truffaut was probably one of my first film texts. I was that kid like asking my parents for like these academic books for Christmas and stuff. And so this was probably one I got in middle school. And it's, so I have this book still and I'm 43 and it's amazing. It's all still intact, but it is. But I love this book so much. So I'm really thrilled that you read it. And yeah, as somebody who I think loves Hitchcock, you're going to get it that way. But also if you don't know a lot and you're just a casual, you don't have to be a cinephile to appreciate Hitchcock Hotel. And I remember you talking about that too, like it wanting to pass the muster of someone who's maybe not a huge movie fan, because, you know, not all people are. Shocking, I know, to me, but someone who has dedicated their professional career to movies. But yeah, and so I do love that you're just gonna appreciate it. Like if you are somebody who likes a good Agatha Christie mystery, this is kind of that vein. There's a little bit, you know, some Du Maurier, some Highsmith. Like you can tell you're a big reader. And also Hitchcock is somebody who adapted a lot of these things and worked with screenwriters and loved books and noir. So it's all there. I love that about this book.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I mean, when my editors and I were talking about this idea, I really wasn't sure how many people of a certain generation, i.e., the younger ones, like were really know about Hitchcock or had seen his movies or really cared about this guy who's been dead for quite a while at this point. And so it was really important to make sure the book stood alone, even if you have never seen a Hitchcock movie or even heard of the guy. It was funny, so I was a few, well, maybe a year ago, maybe a year and a half ago, at the time I was writing the first draft, this high school class in Indiana, the teacher asked if I would Zoom with them because they were reading one of my other books for their English class, which I was like, isn't this a little mature content for a teenager's, but whatever. And so at the end, I asked them, because I was so curious about familiarity with Hitchcock, and I said, how many of you have heard of Alfred Hitchcock? And about half of them raised their hands. I don't know if some of them were just being like, yeah, I totally know. But it is remarkable to think that there are people that don't even know who he is. And so
No.
that illustrates the point, I think, that just like it needs to be a good mystery and thriller on its own. If all those Easter eggs are there if you are a big fan. And I do think like the big fans will probably get a little bit more out of it, but certainly like it can be appreciated and enjoyed, hopefully, without being, knowing anything about him.
Yeah, I think the biggest influences, we're going to talk about a few of the movies, but there's Psycho, obviously, Strangers on a Train, Rope, Rebecca. There's a couple other parts in the movie or the book where I was remembering certain films a little bit more than others. I don't want to spoil certain things. That's what we were talking about when I saw Stephanie last week, that we just wanted to be careful about spoilers because this is something that is dependent on that for sure. So we chose three of the films to talk about, and I know you mentioned you wanted to kind of talk about Hitchcock a little more, and you weren't getting an opportunity to do that on the book tour. So I was really thrilled that you wanted to do that. Do you want to go chronologically with these, or do you have a way in that you would prefer?
Let's start with Psycho because the structure of this book very much borrows from that movie.
It really does. Yes. You know, I am one of those people. I love Psycho. I think it's a masterpiece, but it is not my favorite Hitchcock. And I think a lot of people, when they think of Hitchcock, this is the synonymous, this is his biggest hit. I love that he made it like almost, I wouldn't call it a shoestring budget, but a small budget with his crew from the Alfred Hitchcock Hour. I think it was Hour at that point, not just you know, his previous
Presents,
incarnation, yeah, Presents. And so he worked with people he knew, he trusted. This was a book he found because of Anthony Boucher, loving it and reading a review. And one of my favorite little bits of history is that he was so worried about people knowing, speaking of spoilers, the spoiler, that he bought up all the books, which is kind of, I would imagine as a writer would be like, yay, someone's buying the books, but also, damn it.
I also like the little piece of trivia that like he wouldn't let people into the theaters after the movie started because he didn't want them to like ruin, the they the, it was like you needed to see it from the beginning in order to like fully get the craziness of the twist. Speaking of, do we do spoilers on movies in this
Oh, I
podcast
think
or
these
no?
movies are so old that,
I wasn't sure. Okay. Yeah, so when I went so the main concern or the chief goal that I was trying to do when I wrote this book is I liked the idea of switching genres halfway through, which is what Psycho does. It starts out as a crime caper, and then with the death of Marion, it turns into a psychological thriller.
For sure.
And so I wanted to do that with my book as well. It starts out as a psychological thriller, and then when we find our dead body, it turns into a whodunit. And so I always knew from the beginning of the book where it was going to start. I knew we were going to have this guy, Alfred, standing in the parking lot waiting for his friends to arrive. And then I also knew like who was going to die and at what point in the book, but I did not know who the killer was going to be.
That's amazing to me.
Who was going to do all these like sort of Hitchcockian things, like, you know, some cell phones go missing, some tires get slashed. I did not know who was going to do all of that stuff when I started writing. But
now,
I think
you know about that. At least that was my other question. Did you know like the cell phones and the slashed tires, or did that come to you as you were writing?
Yeah, I knew that because I just kind of, you know, when I started out plotting, and like I said, I did all this research and, you know, obviously the slashed tires is not specific to anything Hitchcock, nor are the missing cell phones. But obviously, you'll notice in almost all thrillers now, like you kind of have to get rid of the cell phones pretty quickly.
Oh my gosh.
Otherwise,
yes.
You know, game over too quickly. And so I had an idea of some of the stuff I did know, like I wanted somebody to start getting sick and like, are they getting poisoned? That obviously is very Hitchcockian. But no, I did not know who was going to be perpetrating this stuff, who was going to be the victim of a lot of this stuff. So that was a super fun little puzzle to figure out kind of as I went.
Yeah, I can't remember which screenwriter was telling me they worked for a television show that they loved kind of writing themselves into a corner and then not knowing where it would go. Like, and being, how did I do that? Like, why was it? And just the amount of brain power, but they actually thought it kept them fresher. And so I love that you were thinking like that. And you did point out something good, that Psycho does start out like a whole different movie. I know in the book, I guess, I haven't read it, but I think her name is Mary. I don't know if it's Marion, but I think she's only in two chapters of like 17.
Oh, really?
And so they decided like, no, we're going to make it, you know, her half the story that way when she is killed and in the, you know, very famous shower scene that scared Janet Leigh so much, she like couldn't take showers except when it was absolutely necessary. And then she had rules for herself about like every window and door had to be locked except for the shower had to be open and the bathroom door in case she had to run. I didn't know that.
Okay. Yes,
she said she didn't realize how vulnerable she was until she made that movie, like how we all are when we take a shower. But in that sequence, that's a lot of people say where the first slasher movie or one of the first slasher movies was born. But I don't like to just write this off as horror because, like you astutely pointed out, it is psychological thriller. And I think that's what you do very well. Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah. I mean, the shower scene, of course, I was like, I got to do something with that. So I didn't go the slasher route. Nobody gets, you know, knifed to death in the shower, but there is a shower scene where somebody does realize they're being watched and sort of goes from there. And then other things that I took from Psycho, like a lot of appearances, a lot of setting, a lot of physical kind of descriptions.
Yeah.
So I picture the Hitchcock Hotel to look like the Bates family house, which was inspired by an Edward Hopper painting, which is
I love that painting.
Which is like the desktop image on my laptop.
I'm a huge Hopper fan. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So that's how I picture the exterior of the Hitchcock Hotel looking. And then, you know, also even down to Alfred Smedel, I picture him as a cross between like Norman Bates and Ichabod Crane, sort of this like tall, skinny guy.
Yes, very much.
Very put together, hair always, you know, like perfect, not a strand
proper.
Out of place.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. So it was lots of stuff to pull from Psycho. I mean, how could you not? So that way, even the most basic fan, you know, kind of gets pulled in that way.
Yeah. And the architecture, I loved in Hitchcock Truffaut, they were pointing out, you know, you have the horizontal motel and then the vertical house, like the differences and where the eye goes. And I thought that was smart. But yes, you know, Hopper is a huge influence on noir. Megan Abbott is one of my friends, and she's a huge Hopper person. Michael Mann loves Hopper and uses him kind of as touchstones. I mean, Heat is full of those images, and a lot of his movies, Thief, they all are. But yeah, so that's interesting, especially because with Psycho, you have isolation and loneliness and all of the things that you get from Hopper. I think this one is so clever because it changes points of view, and your book does too. I wanted to talk more about Alfred's Medal because I was wondering how much Norman Bates influenced him. So that was good. Yeah, I think there's a lot to Psycho. Do you remember the first time you saw this movie?
No, I'm sure I was in my 20s at some point, but I can't remember.
I don't remember the first. Yeah.
For some reason, though, I will say when I rewatched it, you know, a year and a half or whatever ago to kind of reacquaint myself and research, like I was expecting to be so scared. Like for some reason, I had a memory that it was a really scary movie. I don't know if I was just younger or maybe where I was watching it, but like when I rewatched it, I mean, of course, by like 2024 standards, like, listen, these aren't like the Saw movies. Like none of these, whenever people are like, I'm too scared to watch Hitchcock movies, I'm like, oh, no. It's not like that kind of scary. You know, like there's suspense, but you're not like, I might have a heart attack sort of scared. When I rewatched it, or maybe it's just because I knew what was coming, you know what I mean? And when it was coming, but yeah, I remember just feeling almost like the anticipation of the fear more than when I watched it, the actual fear itself, which was weird.
Yes. Well, his movies are kind of full of that. He talks about fear being the primary point that he's getting across in Rebecca. That movie is all about fear. And he said it's to its detriment in places. And I don't know about that. I love that film. But Psycho, it's what you don't show and what we think we see, which is Hitchcock's great thing. And kind of all filmmakers know that. Like Paul Thomas Anderson talked about Heart Eight, the scene where John C. Reilly walks into a hotel and Gwyneth Paltrow's character, or no, it wasn't John C. Reilly, it was Philip Baker Hall, walks in. John C. Reilly and Gwyneth Paltrow called them there for a reason, and you don't know what it is. We just see the reaction, and he waits like a really long time, as long as we can, and we're like dying to know what's in the room. And then we finally do. And Tarantino has talked about doing that with Reservoir Dogs. Like people think they see the ear actually get cut off. And like, I didn't do that. Like what you think you see is scarier.
Sometimes I get questions of like, how gory is this book? I've had that question about all of my books. And the answer is none of them are really that gory, because what the reader can supply or the viewer is so much more horrific than whatever I would actually put on the page. I think it's even more fascinating when audiences, like viewers watching movies, supply that, because you would think like, no, it's literally right in front of my eyes. You know, reading requires you to visualize everything, the entire story. So like you can see how you could supply a scene here or a gory whatever there. But the fact that even viewers like do the same thing where it's like, yeah, I saw the ear, and you're like, no, you didn't. It's crazy. Just the power of the human imagination.
Yes. Yeah. Hitchcock thought that about the shower and the nudity and like how they were going to get away with that. You know, this is a film, Rope is kind of the one that's often cited for his using experimental approaches or putting himself through that. But there are a lot of experimental things that he's doing in this film and all of his films to some extent. Something he didn't achieve in Rebecca wound up inspiring his most famous filmmaking technique that he used in Vertigo, like a problem he couldn't solve then. 15 years later, he figured it out, that kind of thing. But Psycho, I mean, he didn't want to use color famously because of the shower scene and the gore. I am older than you, so I do remember seeing the Gus Van Sant version in theaters, the color, and it was kind of like, why are we doing this? You know, why are we like doing a shot by shot remake just in color? Though I will say overall, it's watchable, it's good. The one thing I took away from it seeing it in color was actually liking the supporting cast. I think it was maybe Viggo Mortensen and Julianne Moore that probably helped, but liking the supporting characters and finding them more interesting than I did watching the original. Now, maybe that's, again, because you have Lee and Perkins and they're so powerful and also just so vulnerable. And there's, like, you know, conflicts and things going on in their characters. You talked about gray areas. So I don't know if it was the black and white or just identifying with these two point of view changes in the original film or what, but I found that interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think Hitchcock, you know, he chose his leads so carefully and was like, so, you know, restrictive and who that could or could not be. So it almost seemed like a lot of times there wasn't a lot of room for the supporting cast to kind of leap off the screen, you know, whereas I think there's more generosity of that and more recent and more recent movies.
Ensembles. Yeah.
And certainly I think, you know, people who are, you know, working actors now who we see all the time, like you just mentioned, Viggo Mortensen or whoever.
Yeah.
I think it's, you just have kind of almost like an on-screen rapport with them. You know what I mean? Where you're like, you've got your actors that you really like. And so you'll give them a chance, or maybe they stand out a little more, like Julianne Moore, like she steals the scene, you know? So I actually haven't seen that remake, but now I'm kind of curious to go watch it.
Yeah. The other thing, I didn't rewatch it ahead of time for this. I haven't seen it in years, but I did watch, Sacha Gervasi made a movie in 2012, Hitchcock, which was about the making of Psycho. And so it was just kind of interesting to watch that. It was more like about Alma, actually, which I thought was interesting. But it was cool just to see some of the challenges and the pushback, you know, between the studio and not wanting to make this and then the limits put on it. And so I think sometimes what you can't show or what you can't do actually can expand and make things more creative. We saw that in the Hays Code era. And I think we see that in Rope a lot. There's so much in subtext and also in Rebecca. To some extent, a lot of that was getting pushed back. And of course the changes made from the novel to the movie. So which one of those do you want to dive into? Unless you had more on Psycho you wanted to share.
No, yeah. Let's talk Rope, because I think something that a lot of people don't know about Hitchcock, and you touched on this already, is how much making movies was about like the technical mastery and the technical experimentation.
Yeah.
You know, like it was eye-opening when I first started doing my research, and he said he thought his best pictures were the ones that had the least amount of dialogue. Mm-hmm. And part of that, you know, comes from his history or his beginning as a silent picture filmmaker.
Yeah.
But then also, you know, the fact that, you know, he tended to think that the movies with less chatter, which, let's be honest, he also wasn't always generous about actors comparing them to cattle and so on. But it was it speaks to how cinematic and how visual he was. And it was, you know, it's hard to do that in a book, like not have much dialogue. But I think Rope is a really good example of, for those that don't know, the technical sophistication there was they, you know, shot it as though it was one continuous scene for 81 minutes, which at the time, like, you would know better than me. I don't know if that had been attempted before.
Not to this level, no, especially with the, you know, the hiding to make it look seamless with the cuts against black. Yes. And then they'd had long takes and things like that, but never 10 minutes and to this level of, you know, bringing the crew in and changing the background. It was something like 200 lights going off the skyline. I actually wrote like a whole thing about the technical part of it when I was in film school. And it was just amazing to see. I think he kind of saw this more. He dismissed it as an experiment. And even Jimmy Stewart has talked about it's not his favorite. He felt like so much time was spent on moving the camera around. Also the silence, because they wanted to be able to record this as it was happening, almost like a play. And Stewart said more time was spent on the technical side than with the actors. And so we kind of got lost in the shuffle, which was interesting. It's the Leopold and Loeb case. I loved what you said about it at Poison Pen when you were saying, like, within the first 45 seconds or something of the movie, we see this murder. These two guys kill their best friend, and then they stuff them in a like a trunk. Is it a trunk, would you say?
Steamer trunk.
Yes. And then they have a dinner party, and it's, you know, are they going to be able to hold it together for the length? There's some cheating on time that some people have pushed back on, so it isn't fully real time because nobody can eat a full dinner like they're eating in 20 minutes, that kind of thing. But it's like, you know, you're suspend your disbelief a little bit when it's that enjoyable. It's very entertaining. So this was also his first color picture, so there was a lot of issues there. I know the cameraman, they got exhausted on how they were doing stuff. So I can't imagine how stressful this one would have been to make. Also, this is one that has so much gay subtext that, like, he famously wanted Montgomery Clift and Cary Grant to do it, and they, you know, didn't want to touch him with a 10-foot pole. Yeah. And so he hired Farley Granger, was known as bisexual. John Dahl was rumored to be gay as well. Arthur Lorentz, who adapted this West End popular play, was gay. And so they talked about how nobody really talked about it when they were making it, but they were all kind of were on the same page, which I'm sure was happening a lot in filmmaking.
Yeah. The first time I watched this movie, I was so taken with it. And I think a lot of audiences now maybe don't have as much love for it because, after all, it's about an hour and a half of people kind of talking and moving around and, you know, not action the way we think of action.
Yeah.
However, after I watched it, I was delighted because I think it's a really funny movie. Like, just the, it's so quippy, which a lot of Hitchcock movies are. I don't think people realize like how much humor went hand in hand with sort of the fear aspect of Hitchcock, but like almost
that's it.
I shouldn't say every movie, but most movies of his are, I've laughed out loud funny at least a few times each movie, you know?
Yeah.
And so when I first watched this movie, it must have been close to when I started writing The Hitchcock Hotel, because initially in the first draft, there is a scene and a whole subplot around someone getting locked in a steamer trunk.
Oh, okay.
So I basically just like wholesale took that. It ended up not really working and it wasn't really realistic for the, you know, what I had in mind. But it, just to demonstrate like how much I wanted to incorporate this movie somehow. And so I ended up finding different ways, you know, there's very long conversations about the perfect murder, committing it, which is a conversation that happens in a number of Hitchcock movies. Shadow of a Doubt is another one where they have, you know, they have the neighbor and the dad have this like long conversation. It kind of repeated, right? It's like their pet topic.
And it's Hume Cronin, who actually worked on the script for this movie, which is so fabulous. Yeah.
Yeah. So that there's a very important conversation in my book where they all kind of sit down to this first dinner and Alfred asks them, you know, how would you commit the perfect murder, which becomes important later in the book. But it was one that is a very overt homage to Hitchcock because, like I said, he did have his characters, whether explicitly or implicitly, were very obsessed with kind of pulling off murders or being around murders or whatever. And I think Rope is like the quintessential example of that because, is it Brendan or Brandon? I think Brendan. I'm not sure. Whatever his name is.
Yes.
Brendan is so obsessed with just like, he's Brandon, superior. Yeah. So why? Yeah, Brandon. Okay. He's superior. He can murder an inferior. Philip is much more like, Brandon's the mastermind, clearly. And Philip's just kind of like going along with it. Maybe hasn't thought it through all the way. Spends the entire film just kind of like terrified. But I think, you know, the way that Brandon like does play this sort of cat and mouse game where he tries to get James Stewart's character, Rupert, I believe, to kind of go along with him, even as the body's there in the trunk, we're kind of talking about murder and how to pull it off and whatever. And the conversation goes, And the conversation goes on so long that one of the guests is really disgusted. And he's like, I can't tell if you're joking anymore.
Yeah.
It's like, I'm not. And the, you know, it's, So yeah, it's just, it's a very interesting pet topic of Hitchcock's that I think is very well done in Rope, because of course there's that additional tension of like, there's literally a dead body 5 feet away.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. And you talked about The Perfect Murder. This is one that you almost think would go as a great double feature with Strangers on a Train, because that opens with, you know, how would you, I have the idea for A Perfect Murder. Like, people just want to talk about them all the time. You know, two strangers, that kind of thing. You have Farley Granger again in that movie. That's such a good one as well. But Rope, yeah, I love what you were saying. It also, because Jimmy Stewart's character was a professor they admire, and he had these sort of lofty Nietzsche, Dostoevsky inspired morality, you know, or what he thought was a moral flexibility or a high ground, or he was almost being controversial just to say things like shock for shock's sake, which we kind of live in that era now. So I thought that was interesting. I think, yeah, there's a lot to this movie for sure. And you brought up humor, which I think was a really good observation, because that's Hitchcock loved that. Like, his least favorite movies when he was looking at his films were the ones that didn't have enough humor. Like I Confess and The Wrong Man were too serious, or like almost docu-style for Wrong Man, and he just didn't think that they worked fully. Rebecca, he called more of a novelette or a women's picture or something than a true Hitchcock. It's kind of more of a Selznick movie, but there is still some funny stuff going on in that one as well. So he can't get away with it or away from it. Even when he's saying, oh, it's not funny, there's still funny stuff going on. And Psycho has some pretty hilarious moments as well.
I think, you know, there's some of it almost, I'm sure it was intentional, but it almost seems unintentional, you know, where it's just like a character says like kind of a throwaway line and you're like, you just like, it's surprising, and right, that's what humor is. It's like, it surprises you, it takes you you know, you're not expecting it. So yeah, I think Rope does that really well. Even rewatching it yesterday, there were like five or six times that I just like chuckled, because it's just like, you know, it's such a ridiculous situation. And yet, like, we are taking it seriously because the characters are taking it seriously, but there's still like the ability to like kind of take the seriousness out of it, I suppose.
Yeah. And you talked about how it kind of inspired the book that you're working on a little bit, or this idea of real time or a limited time frame. That's the next novel you're working on.
Yes. So my fourth book, I can't say too much about it at this point, but yeah, it's going to take place over Christmas dinner. So really only like a 4 or 5 hour period. And obviously it's a lot easier to jump around in time, you know, with a novel, but I think it's such an interesting challenge for a writer. How can we sort of stretch time, but keep it interesting? You know, so we'll see how that goes.
Yeah. Writing yourself into corners, like we talked about, and giving yourself these challenges. Yes. And talking about challenges, Rebecca was the first American movie that Alfred Hitchcock made when he came over. He was working on another Du Maurier, Jamaica Inn, when he read it. He wanted it. He almost like independently wanted to go after the rights, but he could not afford the rights to Rebecca. So Selznick did. But it was still, he said it's still a British picture, but it's made in America because so much, you know, the cast, the crew, not like down to the grips or anything, but a lot of the people involved in this were British. So he did say that. I think this is a fascinating one. I know you are very passionate about the book, so I would love to hear your thoughts on Rebecca.
Yeah, so shamefully, I actually only saw the Hitchcock version of Rebecca like last month. I have been a huge fan of the Du Maurier book for years and years. I've reread it a bunch of times. I have used it as inspiration for a lot of stuff, like my second novel, This Might Hurt, The Cult Leader, Her Name is Rebecca. That is an homage to that. I think just Manderley is such an atmospheric, incredible place. You can see. I even say, like, in the new book, The Hitchcock Hotel, the dining room is supposed to look like the Hitchcock, you know, the Hitchcock set, the dining room there. But anyway, so I had never seen this movie because it was hard to find. Like, I couldn't find it on all the streaming platforms.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And then I randomly found the entire thing is on YouTube for free. Somebody posted it there. And that was the only place I could find it. So I finally watched it and it was incredible. You know, some of the really old stuff, sometimes I find like the actresses are forced to be a little overdramatic, you know, where it's like, yeah. Oh, something stressful happens and like we faint. And it's, you know, yeah. It's just like that kind of overwrought stuff. But I felt like given all of the dramatics that happen in this story, it really holds up. And the chief, you know, my chief love, takeaway, whatever you want to call it, from both the novel and the movie is Mrs. Danvers, who is like one of my favorite characters in literature of all time.
Fascinating character.
Yeah. For those who don't know, who aren't familiar with the story, Mrs. Danvers. Rebecca is this, the dead wife of the first wife of our narrator's new husband, if that makes sense. So this narrator is kind of stepping into the absence that Rebecca has left behind. And Mrs. Danvers was her keeper from the time when she was very young. And Mrs. Danvers is very loyal. She's the antagonist of the story. She is bound and determined to leave our nameless narrator sort of as uncomfortable as possible and even sabotages her at certain points. And so, of course, me, I always go in for like the darkest, strangest, weirdest character. So I've always loved Mrs. Danvers, and she is not in a hidden way at all. She is the inspiration for Danny. You know, that's where the name comes from, who is the housekeeper and kind of the Hitchcock Hotel and kind of Alfred's right-hand man, as it were. So very heavy influence from Rebecca on this book.
Yes, I love that so much. And what you were talking about with like women fainting and that kind of thing, that was actually like, there is a scene where Joan Fontaine's character does, but it makes sense for the role, but or the performance and for the scene. But Hitchcock was saying that was what was maddening to him from a technical standpoint. So he said, when I felt that way, I felt like the world was like both getting farther away from me and also closer. And he wanted to visually represent that. And he said, I just couldn't figure it out on Rebecca. And that is the famous track and the zoom, the combo that he put together for Vertigo, that technique that then Spike Lee and Brian De Palma have used a bunch of times. So that is kind of that technique. So it came from Rebecca, of him wanting to solve this problem of when you feel overwrought, but like for a reason, and your body is letting you down because of shock. Fear is the motivating factor for this, everything that happens. I love that she has no name. She is the second wife of Olivier's character. Hitchcock's talked about he doesn't understand why people always say he's such a romantic character, because, you know, he knows like what happens. So there's a lot of fascinating things going on. They had to change the book's ending, or the ending from the book to the movie. They had to get around the censors a little bit with Danvers' worship and love for adoration of Rebecca, the first woman of Manderley. I also love that it's kind of got that thing like, you know, the house has a name and it's just very Bronte-esque. And of course, you have Olivier, who is in Wuthering Heights, where he said he learned how to act because of the filmmaker. And then you also have Fontaine, who was in Jane Eyre around that time. And I love that version of Jane Eyre too.
Yeah. I mean, there's so much good stuff in there. I will say, I do think the book's ending is absolutely better, but it's interesting how creative and how much time was spent trying to get around censors with so many of these like technical breakthroughs came because Hitchcock wasn't allowed to shoot something the way that he would have preferred to shoot it, you know?
Yeah.
I have so much love for the book and for the movie. And I think it's just so well done. And hopefully that foreboding sense and kind of gloom that's sort of settled over Manderley throughout, you know, from the moment that the narrator kind of pulls up in the car the first time to see the place.
So good.
It's just, and like the whole staff is like almost statuesque. Like I just kind of wanted that to sort of permeate through the Hitchcock Hotel as well. The place, the Hitchcock Hotel, you know, just kind of that very traditional look, the thick curtains and the formal, you know, furniture and whatever. I wanted to lean on that pretty heavily.
Yeah, that's some, all is not what it seems. And also just like Alfred himself, you know, not a hair out of place and trying to be perfect, but what is behind it? Just like we start learning things about Rebecca, and as the film and the book goes on, you start seeing characters in new lights, and that's exactly what you do with Hitchcock Hotel.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, it's if anyone hasn't read the book, read that book and then go watch the movie. You can watch it on YouTube for free.
There you go. Yes. Other books that were favorites or anything that inspired Hitchcock Hotel or any of your books that you want to recommend to people listening?
You know, so we already mentioned the Truffaut interview book. The other one that that was really helpful was The 12 Lives of Alfred Hitchcock.
Oh, that's
by
great.
Edward White.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I liked that one more. It's told in a way, as the title would suggest, it kind of examines each piece of Hitchcock, both the good and the bad, versus just kind of like a chronological dry biography. So I found that one for anyone curious, kind of wanting to dip their toe. And I think give like a pretty fair portrayal of the man and the director.
Absolutely.
I would suggest picking that book up.
Yeah. All the critical aspects and seeing the full person. Yes, for sure.
Yeah.
Because he isn't just this teddy bear looking guy that you might see, you know, climbing onto a bus in the background of a shot. So yes, absolutely. Well, Stephanie, I want to thank you so much. Any other Hitchcock movies that are favorites of yours that people should seek out?
I really love Strangers on a Train. I think the premise of that was, you know, that was another potential book idea, was like, what's a modern day take on like kind of the murder for a murder thing? I mean, it's just like such fertile ground. And then also Rear Window. That was a huge influence as well.
Film.
Just, you know, voyeurism, kind of like this whole ensemble. I mean, it's not an ensemble cast, truly. They're all very minor characters, but kind of just watching all these people go about their day. And, you know, I can't remember, what's the ballet dancer called? Lonely something.
There's Miss
No, that's somebody
Lonely Hearts,
else.
And then there's, the pelvis or that lady.
Yes. Yeah, the lady who's like always stretching for some reason. So just like kind of having that Jimmy Stewart just kind of like watching, you know what I mean? Like there's obviously a lot of voyeurism and that kind of sense of being watched throughout the book. So I love that movie just on its own. And that's why I ended up bringing a lot of it into the book as well.
Yeah. So much. I mean, the old line is that like all movies are really about filmmaking, even when they're not. But, you know, Hitchcock's movies are very confessional and they're sort of about control and the act of watching. And so all of that is in there. And that's something that is, you know, going throughout your book. So, Stephanie, I want to thank you so much for doing this. It was such a pleasure.
No, thank you again for having me. It was super fun.
Yeah, of course. Anytime you want to come back, talk about movies, your next book, whatever, just let me know.
Great. Will do. Sounds great.
I also want to thank everyone for listening, especially my patrons who support the show and help fund my research, equipment, film rentals, RSS fees, and more for as little as $1 per month at the Film Intuition Patreon, which is the home base for the show. Other ways you can support the podcast are by sharing, reviewing, and subscribing to Watch with Jen wherever you get your podcasts, and also checking out the cool merch store hosted and created by our talented logo designer, Kate Gabrielle. You can find the merchandise store, including shirts, tote bags, stickers, and more, by visiting filmintuition.com and clicking on the shop link. The show's theme music is Solo Acoustic Guitar by Jason Shaw and is available in the Free Music Archive. You can also reach me or interact with Watch with Jen anytime on Twitter, either at Film Intuition or our Watch with Jen account as well. Well, until next time, please take care and happy movie watching.
This is Jen Johans at filmintuition.com and Film Intuition on social media and Letterboxd. And this is Watch with Jen.